each one of them will just go through their presentation, and then that hopefully will leave time for lots of questions for them. So welcome.
Hi, I'm Mary Maloney. I'm with Honeywell right now, and I work in their international division. And just so I am going to talk about the right things, can I see the hands of how many of you are area majors, area studies, Chinese studies majors? Okay. How about business majors? What are the rest of you? Undecided?
We have some high school students here.
Oh, okay. High school. How many high school students? And how many of you are studying Chinese? Right. I just wanted to get a feel for them. Quickly, my background. I've only been in the real world about a year and a half, so I'll try to give you a good idea, but I'm still a little ivory tower. I went to Carleton College, majored in international relations, spent about a year in Europe doing that stuff. Then I went to Columbia University School of International Affairs. It's a professional master's program, very similar to an MBA in the sense that it's 2 years of coursework, no thesis, and it prepares you for a job, not a PhD program. And I'd be happy to take any questions about that program and the programs that are similar to that, because it's quite relevant to doing business in China, I believe. A pretty good preparation. I also won a scholarship, a Rotary Fellowship, to study in Japan for 2 years. Studied Japanese and Japanese economics and business. I speak Japanese. So my background is not China. I did some area studies in Asia as a whole. And my work right now has me doing a bit more with China than I do with Japan. And let's see, then I started with Honeywell last year, did some marketing, now I'm in their international division. Pretty much staff support to a vice president of international, and it's really a training position so that eventually someday I can get into international marketing. That's the background. Let me tell you real briefly what Honeywell is doing in China. Honeywell's a big company. We're about $6 billion. We're all over the world, everywhere. The stuff we do in the PRC is we're really just getting started, as most companies are. We've been there a few years. We had a major large computer sale to the Ministry of Education. We do some of our industrial process controls. We have licensing agreements with the Chinese on that, valves, pneumatic controls. Obviously, since they're a developing country, we do more of the heavy industrial side or computers rather than maybe residential thermostats and some of the other businesses that we're in. And also we do no aerospace and defense because of government problems. There are some discussions. Let's see. I just have a list of everyone Honeywell has working in China just to give you an idea. I counted about 59 people who spend over 75% of their time working on the PRC. Now, just to give you an idea of how American companies structure their organizations abroad, I counted maybe 4 or 5 Americans out of that 59. Now, part of that's because a lot of what we do in China is through our Japanese company. We have a Japanese joint venture, and they do a lot of their business with China. So there's a lot of Japanese in here, maybe 20 or 30, I guess. And we have locals, we have maybe 12 PRC nationals, and a lot of the people are Hong Kong, and they work out of the Hong Kong office and go into the PRC. So Americans working overseas are very expensive. Okay, I don't know about China, but in Tokyo, it costs the average American corporation $150,000 a year plus salary to keep someone in Tokyo. So they're not going to send a lot of us overseas. And we're going to have to be pretty good at what we do. And you're not going to be very young. You're going to be, at least at a company like Honeywell, you're probably going to be mid-career, at least maybe 35 years old. And you're going to know your industry very well. And you're going to have some good line experience before they're going to send you. You're going to know how to run a business and have profit and loss responsibility before you go. Because usually that's what you're doing over there, unless you're a technician, an engineer, computer science, that kind of job. Usually you're a manager of an operation. That means you have to have profit and loss responsibility experience. Okay. This may vary according to companies. I'm just giving you Honeywell. Let's see. Just some reality testing. Language is not enough for those of you who are studying language. It doesn't look like too many of you are just in area studies. But I was very heavy academic, heavy area studies. I had my concentration in my degree was in business, and so I had some of that background. But if I hadn't had that, it would not have been very easy to get a job at Honeywell or a big company. I did a lot of interviewing. Banks are very good. Banks like people with international background and language, and they might take you with that, and then they have their own training programs, and they don't worry so much if you have a business degree or a business background. But right now, multinational corporations, you know, language is never just going to do it. You got to have a functional background. And I think to be successful in business, in international business, you have to have your strongest suit probably has to be your business background, either marketing, finance, computers, engineering, something like that. And then you enhance that with your language ability. Okay. One way to get this background is if you want to get into this major in something, double major, or do your undergrad in regional, do your grad like an MBA. That's one way to bring that together. Another way to do it is get internships if you can through your school programs. Work in the real world. Get out, work in a company. Maybe it has nothing to do with international. Just do marketing. Study your area of studies and then bring it together later. You're going to have to do a lot it's kind of hard. Like I'd take my economics and my business courses and I'd take my Asian history courses, and right now, even at very good schools, there's not a lot that mixes. It's not like a Japanese economics course or a Chinese economics course or Chinese business. You have to do a lot of that on your own, but I think you're going to benefit the most out of that. I think American companies have to get very serious about hiring people with international background. They're just starting to realize that. They will hire you. It's going to take a sales job on your part. You have to say, this is what I can offer you, because they don't always know right away. But companies like Honeywell are starting to make a commitment, hiring young people with international expertise, teaching them the industry, and then sending them overseas. That's all I have to say. Fast.
Very good. I'm David Lang, president of CardioPace Medical. CardioPace is a small biomedical engineering company in Roseville, which specializes in implantable heart pacemakers. My background is as follows. I received a BA in economics from Harvard University, which prepared me for absolutely nothing in China, or for that matter, international business. I took some graduate courses at the university in international economics, never finished the program. CardioPace became involved in China at my direction exactly 3 years ago. In November of 1983, we had a consultant tag along on a Minnesota state-sponsored trade delegation to Shaanxi Province in China. Shaanxi Province is the sister state in China of Minnesota. At that time, we initiated a letter of intent to continue talking about the possibility of entering a joint venture to build these pacemaker products, these medical devices. That November 1983 letter of intent was followed by a visit of myself and our consultant in March of 84, followed by a summer and fall of letter writing, telex communication, what have you. In March of 85, a rather large Chinese delegation visited the company. We signed the agreement. The formal signature took place actually in May of 85 back in China. It was submitted to the Chinese government and officially approved in December of 1985, 2 years in the making. By some standards, swift, but by some Western standards, rather slow. We're very pleased the way it's developed to date. The business license for the joint venture was then issued 3 months after government approval. As part of the provisions of this joint venture contract, the Chinese partner, who owns 51% of this joint venture, contributed, and this is typical in a Chinese joint venture, contributed the factory, the land, and in our case, the majority of the cash. Cardio pays for its 49% equity position, contributed $250,000 of equipment, a certain amount of cash, and $500,000 of technology. The technology transfer fee associated with this joint venture was agreed upon by the partners at $500,000, which our company put back in as its equity contribution to a capitalization of about $2 million. Again, a small project. In terms of what is negotiable in a Chinese venture, one should never limit themselves because, it's my opinion, everything is negotiable. Salaries, where they're paid, who contributes what. The management team was one of the smoother episodes in our negotiations in that the Chinese partner insisted that we, as the American partner, nominate the general manager, the quality assurance manager, and the export sales manager. For their part, they nominated the assistant general manager, production, domestic sales, and accounting. That signaled to us they wanted to learn a little bit about American management technique and that they were concerned about the quality of their production techniques and insisted that we nominate the quality assurance manager and operate the factory under FDA standards as if it were situated in the United States. What's happened to date? The facility was finished in August. Equipment was delivered in August and September. All the people were trained, all the documents translated, and in fact, that little company is going into production this month. For CardioPace, it's been a very, very pleasant experience. We learned a great deal. The Chinese negotiated with a high degree of integrity, and we couldn't be more pleased with our association there. What are some of the obstacles? Foreign exchange, for one, a severe shortage, which can be overcome in some ways other than strict barter. We happen to secure a guarantee from the Bank of China for the first 3 years of our operations, which guaranteed access to foreign currency. Chinese currency is not considered a hard currency and tradable in international markets. So either through export or through bank guarantees or through some means, one has to assure themselves of the flow of hard currency through their Chinese operation. For this company, it was particularly difficult because all of the components for this joint venture are sourced in the United States. So each time a product is built, it generates approximately $500 foreign currency requirements. Another obstacle, in addition to the lack of hard currency or shortage of hard currency, is a bureaucratic system that one must treat delicately. But at the same time give a good boost because things move rather slowly. Another potential problem is in the area of staffing. It was our experience that what we would consider staffing in a typical American enterprise, 50 people, their intention could be as many as 200 people. Those problems were easily worked out with our joint venture partner, and we found them to be very, very flexible. I can only endorse the comments that Mary made relative to the types of courses you should pursue. I think international finance, particularly with China, understanding the joint venture law is extremely important. A joint venture is the preferred method of China to acquire technology. There are some licensing agreements, but it's my opinion that most Chinese state-owned enterprises want a partner to guarantee source of raw materials, to guarantee management, to guarantee advancing technology from their partners. Our agreement is for a term of 15 years. 15 years from now, Hong Kong will be part, less than 15 years, Hong Kong will be part of China. 15 years is the year 2001. At that point, the agreement is subject to extension, it's subject to cancellation, and is subject to a buyout agreement from either partner. International finance, joint venture law, there's no substitute for going there. We have three expatriate Americans living there, and I can assure you it's not a joyride. It's something you do for a couple of years, come home and almost feel you can write a book. Western amenities are absolutely non-existent. We are in a small city of 450,000 people called Baoji. It is about 100 miles west of Xi'an, and there are days you go without water. In fact, there are several days in a row you go without water and heat, and things are improving rapidly, but it's a totally, totally different style of living. I don't think there's any substitute for, I think if you do it right, you can get to Hong Kong for about $800 round trip, and you can subsist in China for a whole lot less than you can in St. Paul, Minnesota, and if you can scrape together $1,000, you may learn a whole lot just going there for a couple of weeks. Thank you.
My name is Randy Boyer, and I'm an attorney with the Popham Hake Law Firm. We have, we're about 100 attorneys, have offices in Washington, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Denver. What do I do? Well, I do exactly what David was talking about in terms of negotiating joint venture agreements. That's my involvement in China, is negotiating joint venture agreements and protecting intellectual property rights in the Far East. I also do other international and corporate business and intellectual property law for the firm, but my Chinese involvement is in joint venture and intellectual property protection. To give you just a quick overview of how I got to China, how I got involved in China, was rather circuitous, but I'm an English major from the University of Minnesota and got a law degree at Hamline Law School. Have been a member of a large law firm ever since, except for a short period of time early in my career. Was always interested in China, did a lot of reading and studying in background area studies in Asia. But it wasn't until I got involved in high technology law that I started getting involved into the international scene. And I think that you should keep in mind that Minnesota and its high technology industries, and David's company is a perfect example in the biomed area. But biomed, bioengineering, computers, software, and related technologies are big and growing industries in Minnesota, and there's a lot of opportunity internationally because a lot of other countries other than the United States are interested in those products. So companies that sell those kinds of products are going to be doing business internationally, and there'll be opportunities with those companies in the ensuing years to get involved in international. And the reason why Asia is so important, China being one of the crucial countries, is a lot of economists have been looking at the world economy, and they see the growing emergence of Pacific Rim as a seat of economic power. And so it's clear to many people, and a lot of people think it's probably true, that over the next generation we're going to see a lot of business opportunities be created there. So it's an area that a lot of you are foresightful in getting involved in. Again, how I got involved in this, I represent high technology companies, and they've been, as they've expanded, they've seen their markets grow beyond just domestic markets in the United States, first to Canada, and then to Europe, and now to Asia, and they need legal advice on how to protect their intellectual property rights and how to do business in those countries. And when that started to happen a few years ago, I got involved with my firm in learning about how that happens, and since then have been practicing doing just that. Also, I'm the president-elect, and I'm running for the presidency of the Minnesota Software Association, which is a trade association of software companies. And because of that, and because of my involvement with the Minnesota Trade Office, and at the behest of the Trade Office and the governor, I've been on two trade missions to the PRC, trying to interest the Chinese in Minnesota software companies and Minnesota software products. And that work continues, and there's a lot of interest on the part of the Chinese, but it's a long process. As I think you might have gotten the indication from David's remarks, it takes sometimes years to start, after a lot of discussions, to get things rolling. The Chinese like to do business with friends, and so it takes a while to become friends, especially when you're halfway around the world. And that means a lot of time and some risk in terms of time and investment in pursuing that. One point that I want to stress is the Minnesota or the Midwest China Center's role in trade with China. I don't know if many of you really realize how important the Midwest China Center is. I do business with a lot of different clients and have been involved in China trade for a while, and the Midwest China Center is a focal point for businesses and education and culture, cultural exchange with China, and it's a wonderful organization to be in touch with and involved with. They put on great seminars and they're it's really important to, whenever you are at the point of your career that you're looking for opportunities, that you touch base with the Midwest China Center, because they will know what's going on, at least from a Minnesota or a Midwest perspective in terms of trade with China. If you wanted to become an international lawyer and do what I do and represent companies in terms of doing business in Asia and doing business in China, it's a long road. I mean, it's an undergraduate career of 4 years or more, depending upon if you go full-time. And you would need to do the kinds of things that the other speakers have been talking about in terms of education. You'll want to have a business background. You want to have a full liberal arts background. I think it's a big mistake to just focus on business and nothing but business or any one particular. I think you want to get a rounded background in your education, and I think employers like to see that for the most part. Then after you've gotten 4 years and gotten your bachelor's degree, you've got to go to law school, and there are some law schools like Columbia and a few others in the East Coast that have particular programs that focus on international law and international business law, and those would be the best to get involved in. But you're going to need top grades in order to do it, so you'll have to really try extremely hard to focus your attention on your schooling and get good grades so that you can enter those programs. Knowing Chinese in the future is going to be essential for any lawyer that wants to do to represent clients in that area of the world. And to the extent that you've started that, you've got a step forward. You've got a jump start on other people. And then the people that are doing most of the international law representation are in the larger law firms, and they're difficult to get into because the large law firms usually get the pick of the cream of the crop, and which means that you really have to do extremely well in school and do well in entrance exams and those kinds of things in order to get to that point. There will be room for some career development in international law with some smaller firms as the U.S. market penetrates Asia more. But at this stage of the game, or this stage of development with trade with China, only the real top people that have gotten into international law are doing work there. At this stage, I think we should open up for questions. Oh, one other comment. I wanted to comment on Mary's remarks about Honeywell. I visited many of the computer installations throughout the software institutes in China, and virtually everyone that I visited, the Honeywell hardware equipment was being used, the DPS series. So they made good market penetration, at least among the educational institutes in China.
First of all, when the obstacle of foreign exchange surfaced, it was a result of a lengthy discussion about the financial goals of the joint venture, which sounded like the financial goals of a company in the United States, 10% after-tax profit. Profit may have been a bad word in China years ago, but it certainly isn't today. Further, the chairman of the board, who was Chinese, had indicated that the government would shut the facility if it was not profitable between year two and three. This general discussion ensued about financial projections of the company. How would we fund the purchase of raw materials from the United States, since I can assure you none of our vendors were interested in taking the local Chinese currency in form of payment. The Bank of China was brought in, and we simply said for this project to go forward, we need guarantees of conversion of the local currency into a hard U.S. dollar for the initial three-year period. At which point, we've got a couple options. One, to export more and build that in a hard currency, probably U.S. dollars. Two, integrate some Chinese components. As risky as that may sound, we have evaluated certain batteries. Our joint venture partner is a circuit manufacturer, and I would suspect in year 3 to 5, we will be using some Chinese components for that unit manufactured in China, which will lessen our need for foreign exchange. Dividends paid to Cardiopaste as a 49% owner of that company are included in that conversion rate. And when faced with these concrete, tangible obstacles, the Chinese become very resourceful. It's the conceptual areas that are more bothersome than if you put the numbers on the board and they don't come out right. You know, the immediate solution was get the Bank of China in here. Sure. No. I personally conducted all the negotiations. And in deference to legal counsel here, we never brought an attorney into the picture until the joint venture partners agreed on what they wanted to do. And that included the Chinese partner. We never saw legal counsel in any of the negotiating sessions until it was time to submit the document to the government. And so those discussions went on for 2 years without legal counsel. China itself is not nearly as legalistic as the United States is. I mean, it's even trademarks and patents, I mean, it's still rather murky, to say the least. One more point. There was much concern on the part of our board of directors that this technology may be pilfered and the factory would start two blocks down the road. In fact, each and every employee of the joint venture has signed, and it's not been tested, and we hope we won't have to test it, but has signed a non-compete agreement with the joint venture company, and the non-compete clause is for a period of 10 years.
On the non-compete question, I'd like to ask the lawyer, is that going to stand up in China? I've had trouble finding out what the court system is, so we'll never pick the case in China, or in the United States. I'm really not putting that down.
That's a very fair question. We don't know at this point.
The best way to resolve disputes in China is to do it informally with your partner, your joint venture partner, and the joint venture partner is hooked into a vertical chain going from the central government all the way through the provincial government. And what you need to do is to go to each step up one level every time if you're not getting satisfactory remedy to the particular problem. And once you go through that process and you still haven't gotten satisfactory remedy, then there are usually most joint venture agreements, most contracts have some kind of arbitration provision. Then it would be arbitrable. But the Chinese are trying to set up a judicial system, and they have set up a judicial system. And the new civil code that was just passed earlier this year has a clause in it that says that any breach of intellectual property rights or rights in technology, and we're not quite sure what that means because no other country has used that particular language before, but they specifically cite copyright, patent, trademark, trade secret rights, can be enforced by injunction or other appropriate remedy. And that's almost a direct translation of the particular statute. So the government is trying to provide statutory sources for appropriate relief. My experience is you can 99% of the time solve it with just an informal mediation with the parties. I've never seen, now there's been very few arbitrations that have actually transpired, and as far as I know, no judicial actions that have ever been taken. Whether that's going to change in the future, it's hard to know. There's more and more lawyers being trained in China, and there's more and more trade between the two countries. But I think that mediation and arbitration are by far going to be the ways of solving disputes in China for a long time.
I don't know of any. What we've mostly been doing with China, besides some of our computer sales, is licensing agreements, selling them technology, getting them up and running in manufacturing, and hopefully buying some back when the quality is sometimes wrong.
The stated goal in our joint venture contract is to attempt to export 30% of the production of that facility. North America is off limits. They have no marketing rights for their product in North America. However, they would be able to export it to any other country. Practically speaking, we see in the first couple of years most of that export going to Southeast Asia. But there, beyond that export agreement, there is no requirement or agreement for Cardiopace Medical in St. Paul to buy that product or to accept any goods and services in lieu of payment. Nothing.
Can you explain a little bit about the program that you went on to after Carl? What were you going to make the reasons that you chose that versus getting some information?
Okay. My reason for going to grad school isn't a very good one. I didn't want to pay my student loans back yet. I'm suffering for that now because I just built up bigger ones. The reason, and also one of the reasons I went, is I wanted to go to law school, mostly because I didn't know what else was out there. And as I got involved in international relations, I found that it was a field I enjoyed thoroughly. And so I thought, why not study more of this? Now, that's probably not a very good reason. And when I talk to younger people now, I say, don't go to graduate school right after undergrad. Just don't do it. That's my advice. And that's from talking to a lot of people. And the reason I say that is because you learn so much more about what you want to do once you're out. And even if you learn you hate something, you learn that. You haven't learned that when you just keep going to school. The first year I went to this program, I wasn't as directed as I should have been because I hadn't done anything. Then I went over to Japan, and I was again a student, but I was learning a lot more. When I came back to finish my last year of my master's program, I was much more directed and got 100% more out of my second year than I did my first. Okay, so that's, if maybe people will disagree. I say, get out there, CBUM, work, be a manager to Kentucky Fried Chicken. You're going to learn something. And then go back. If you hate it and you say, I want to make myself better, I want to earn more money, then you've got much more direction. That's one piece of advice. Now, about the program, the only thing that I think is bad about it is that you're given such a range of things to do that if you don't have the direction, it's like two more years of liberal arts education. Which you've had, and it's great, and it's a wonderful background, but you don't want to do that at law school. You want to start getting focused, okay? The program is, there are, okay, maybe seven programs like this out there now. Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy works through Tufts University and Harvard. Princeton has a Woodrow Wilson School that's mostly foreign service, government oriented. All these schools are getting a little, they're moving much more toward business labor. It used to be more foreign service. Georgetown has one. Johns Hopkins has a School of Advanced International Studies. Columbia's is called School of International Affairs. And they're growing. Thunderbird out in Glendale, Arizona is in international management. Now that's just business, the one in Thunderbird. Thunderbird School of International Management. Like American, oh, okay. And Columbia, there's really no faculty in this school, and I think some of the other programs are like this. You just have a dean, a couple deans, and they say, here's Columbia University, this tremendous resource, go and experience it. And they give you, out of, I think you have to take 12 classes to graduate, four classes. You can take a little more than that if you want. And maybe five of those are required. You have to have a diplomacy class, you have to have international trade, you have to have, those are mostly political, okay? Then you can go off and you can major in, or concentrate in a function, journalism, and you take journalism classes. Law, you can take law school classes. Business, you can take business classes. All at the business school, at the law school, et cetera. Public health, you go to the School of Public Health. So it's a great resource. But you have to know what you want to do, or you're just going to start running around and going crazy because everything is interesting. Then they have regional concentrations. And what a lot of people do is combine them. What I did is did East Asia and business. And that's a real good way to do it. The regional studies, they're called Regional Institutes of Columbia, but I think they have similar programs at Harvard and Johns Hopkins, are excellent. They have some of the best faculty on those areas in the world, or in the United States, and it's fascinating to study with them. So I think it's one option, one way to get into business or government, a lot of things international. But, and I would recommend it strongly to anyone who has that kind, those kind of ambitions. My warning is that know what you want. Know you want to be a journalist in, you know, and concentrating in Africa. You can do that. You have to know before you go, you're going to waste your time. It's 2 very short years. Does that answer?
Yeah.
Okay. Certainly. And I get back to the same point again. I took accounting, marketing, finance, took basics.
International or
no? There's very little. It's really sad. The business schools Columbia is supposed to be one of the best business schools in international business, and not yet. I mean, they're just, no one's doing it enough, you know? You gotta do it on your own. You gotta take the Asian studies courses and apply them with business. There are international business courses that you can take, and those are good, but if you take accounting or finance, you're not gonna have any international elements. Okay, now, yes, they apply. Yes, I know much more, when I look at an annual report, I know a little bit more about finance than I did if I hadn't taken those courses. But no, they weren't nearly as useful as if I had were taking them now, and maybe in 5 years or in 2 years. And the quality, the best business schools won't even let you in unless you've had 2 or 3 years of business experience. And I know why now, because I sat and listened to the questions some of these students are answering and are questioning of professors, and they're wonderful. But I couldn't do that. I couldn't be inquisitive in that manner because I had not experienced it. So it's worthwhile to take an accounting course before you go into business, yes, but it's much better if you're out there and you're like, oh, what is this mean? What is this? And then you go back and you say, yep, that's why I need to know that.
I have a question for Mr. Lang. Can you elaborate on how Cardio pays
made initial contact with Chinese? It's a rather personal story that I will try to summarize real briefly. There was a gentleman in town who today is now the export sales manager in the joint venture, Chinese American, who was a special trade representative of the governor and worked closely with the Minnesota Trade Office and happened to be a friend of a personal Chinese friend of mine. He came to the company and basically said, are you interested in trying to do some business in China? They would like to build a pacemaker. And he was the gentleman that accompanied, I think it was Harry Sieben at the time, Speaker of the House, on this trade mission to China in the fall of 83. That's how it started.
Did Cardio Pace at that time had any expectations, objectives as to what they want out of
China? No, none whatsoever. As a matter of fact, he left about November 1st, and the letter of intent was signed on November 14th, and it shocked everybody. It just happened so fast. Now, the provisions of the letter of intent were vague and almost meaningless, but the letter itself was the important document, and it simply said, we agree to continue to talk about these possibilities. The following meeting, 6 months later, the letter of intent was transformed into an agreement in principle, and what started as the technology transfer was now a proposed joint venture. But no, we had, and further, when we went in, we had not well-defined goals for ourselves. In fact, I always felt during the negotiations the Chinese partner knew a lot more about what they wanted out of this relationship than we did.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing that I think Mary is saying, unbelievably, when I graduated from Harvard, I could not do a P&L projection. I had a hard time reading the stock market. To me, it's a sad commentary on the lack of practicality in some academic courses at some academic institutions. And Mary's proposal that you spend a year or two or so in a business environment is one that would get my endorsement by 1,000%. The other thing I just want to say is when you take a look at China, realize that China is changing very, very rapidly. If you take a course on the Chinese economy, I do a little background on the currency of the person giving the course. I mean, how current is that person? Because I normally get to China once every 4 to 6 months, and I am amazed what takes place in that period of time. In the last 30, 45 days, if I'm not mistaken, China allowed its first bankruptcy. Stocks started trading on a stock market in Shanghai. I mean, this is incredible for a so-called communist country. So, I think those courses are great. I think if you're really, really interested, you could subscribe to the China Daily. There is an overseas version in English. And when you take a course, I advise you to make sure that the teacher is up to date. I found early on when I was at the graduate school that traveling around the world and working in an international division of a much larger company that in fact I felt I was studying last year's reports, and it was discouraging.
Well, like I said, I think the regional institutions were really excellent and up to date. I think, but the lack I saw was, again, I'm mostly Japan, and there are maybe 5 Japanese economists in this country, 5 that are decent, that know anything about post-war Japanese economy, and it is sad. And you can study Tokugawa era Japanese, but you can't study post-war, and that's
I have a question for you. Okay, we have a current college graduate.
A what?
We put all of our MSLE people in these kinds of jobs, and then after they prove themselves, we promote them, or are there exceptions made? Can we generalize?
Okay. I'm an exception. I am not a typical Honeywell employee by any stretch of the imagination. But like I said, Honeywell and some big companies are making a commitment to hiring people that have international sensitivity. And that's something I probably haven't emphasized enough. Just because I have a strong Asian background and not a business background, I'm probably different from you. Study the language by all means. Keep that up. Do that too. That's essential. But it's going to enhance your function. You can either make yourself so attractive and so unique that they're going to treat you specially and give you a job someplace. Now, I don't want to sound elitist or anything, but somehow someone believed in me at Honeywell and said, this person is unique. We're going to give her a job. She's probably not very productive right now, and we're probably overpaying her, but we want her in the future. Okay. And you can do that. If that's not going to happen to everyone. I mean, believe me, I interviewed a lot of companies and they weren't making me offers like this. That's why I came here. But I'd say if you're right out of college and you're interested in international business, I'd go to Honeywell and say I want to be a sales rep. Forget the international. You're not going to get it entry level. There's no international entry level jobs at Honeywell. I can guarantee you there are not. And I'm an exception. And I didn't do international my first year there. And I'm not going to do international when I'm done with this job. I'm going to go back and do line marketing. You become a great marketer, and then I'm going to go overseas. Okay. So I'd go and I'd be a sales rep. that's the best way to start. If something, if you want to get into marketing or finance, you want to do the finance accounting side, do it. Then go to graduate school maybe or not, and express an interest in international, keep up your language, join associations, and you'll eventually get into international. I know it's a sad picture, you know, but banks are an exception. If you go into a bank, get the training program and all the accounting stuff, and they'll put you right into international, and they're really interested in international.
Okay. Well, I just have a question more so, well, actually, goes more to the language. Who does, like, the translating of documents and stuff? The kind of mentions translating the description of the iPhone made two different things. And everybody keeps saying, well, the language is nice, but it only enhances. Well, isn't there an opportunity for people to actually become a translator?
Of course, of course. And we've all dealt with them. Interpreting and translating, sure, you can get into it. And it's just, I personally, Japanese isn't good enough to do that. But I'm not excited by that. So personally, I just didn't do that. And so I was excited more by business and enhancing with the Japanese. And that's my bias. Yes, there are jobs out there being translators and interpreters. The one thing I'd warn you about, again, there are a lot of Chinese Americans, Japanese Americans, that are bilingual. And I'm not sure what the market is. I haven't looked into it. It's something you want to look into. But there are people, good friends of mine, who are just as good at English as they are Japanese or Chinese. And they didn't have to study. And they can translate back and forth. Now, I check the market. I see. Then there are people, my Japanese comes in handy. I'm not going to use it for negotiations. It isn't that good. I don't want to have to think that hard about just speaking the language. I want to think about the business contract that I'm talking about. But I can tell you if there's a good translator there. I can tell you if it's bad. I can tell you when the Japanese are whispering across the table what they're saying about my company. I mean, that all comes in. So, but if you're interested in that, if there's a field, then I just check it out.
I found it's hard finding translators that have any knowledge of technology. Mm-hmm. And so it's difficult when you're talking about a specific kind of technology or some aspect of that. I've gotten, you know, we've wasted a day talking about the wrong thing if a translator made a mistake. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I really respect the rest of the session, but anyway, here.
What I'd like to ask is, so many of you here, is whatever product or whatever company you're dealing with, you have to train some people, and likewise, they may have to train you, whether you're manufacturing or whether you're selling. What kind of careers, or is there a specific career for someone training?
I know Honeywell trains all the time. We train the Chinese. For the computers, we train them all the time. The training we do is predominantly product technical training. And I would say that the people who do it have no international background. It would certainly help them if they did have international background. But we also, like I said, our association with China is more from Hong Kong and Japan. Okay, and I know the Japanese, they're much better about learning foreign languages than we are. And they've got Japanese that are running around speaking Chinese and training people probably in Chinese. And then we've got people who work for us in Hong Kong that already speak Chinese that are doing that. So we don't really need to rely on Americans all the time. But we do sometimes, and actually, I know one person who's Chinese-American, and he's also a PhD in engineering, and he does some of that. He also does some negotiations for us. And then I've just been talking to some people who have no international background. They just happen to be the same people who teach the Americans, and we just use translators. I don't know about you guys.
I think it's uncommon to find in the so-called high-tech area someone who is both bilingual and highly technical, so that one person can be doing your training. We generally work through translators. And in terms of training the production people, that was handled exclusively by our quality assurance manager, who fortunately was Chinese-American.
Mr. Lang, Mary said, Ms. Maloney said, to get in the Honeywell, she advised over to bring in the sales rep. Would that similarly apply to a company like yours?
My suggestion would be to get in the company. Take any job and let it be known you have a strong interest in international, but get employed in the company. It's tough to get into international as an entry-level position. Most companies like to see some performance before they invest in your international career, because it gets expensive. And just get in. Get in, do your best, and let everybody know that someday you want to be in international operations.
I have another comment about that, too. I eventually want to work for a small company or start my own company or be a consultant. I mean, that's years down the line. And one of the things I ran into, I started applying to small companies that I knew had little offices in Japan or were competing with Japan, and I just thought, wow, getting to a venture business, small thing, they wouldn't hire me. No way. They couldn't afford me. They couldn't afford to train me. And they said, go to a big company, and get training for 3 years or 4 years, learn how to do marketing, know the industry, then we'll headhunt you. And so that's just another thing. I mean, I was much more intrigued with the small startups, and I don't know, I wasn't out in California at all. Maybe there were some things I could have done out there, but it was one of the things I ran into, or something that I thought was too bad, that I couldn't get into a small company and really go for it. I had to go to a big company that was willing to put all this money into me and train me.
So, like, you talked about the best way for your company to just get into it. How does one get into it?
That's a real good question.
I know.
Where do you buy this thing called experience?
Exactly. And I think that's kind of the bottom line of everyone wants. MBA programs want you to have business experience. And I think you probably can generalize that probably there is business experience in business experience. You could probably say, yes, I went to McDonald's, that's business experience. I think if you applied to Harvard and said, my business experience was working at McDonald's, unless you could really tell them what was so great about that experience for you, they were doing very well. Really got someone who worked for solid money. Maybe I shouldn't generalize. But if someone's going to your company as they just graduated, are you going to get a better chance say you're going to send your resume to the personnel department or just coming in? Are you at least going to get an interview?
In our company, yes, you would. But bear in mind, we have about 40 employees. In sales, you go out to qualify accounts, and you start with this great big funnel opening and you flow them into really qualified, interested people. I think you have to do the same thing when you're looking for employment. My own personal experience, I came out of the service in 1970. Not a brilliant year to get employment, if you look at the economics of the last decade or two. And started interviewing at banks, followed the newspaper, applied to a company called Medtronic, had no idea what Medtronic made the day I applied there. And in 1970, Medtronic's a $400+ million company today. In 1970, I think they were probably doing maybe 30. Took a position as a market research analyst and got in. And fortunately, 6 months later, got into their international division. And 2 years later, got relocated to Paris and Munich. And essentially, during my 15 years in business, it's predominantly been international.
Well,
but getting in, and I ask myself that same question, experience, experience, experience. Where do you buy this thing? Where can I get this thing called experience? And it's really tough. But you have to, you never know when you apply or when you interview where that road is leading. Never. Just maximize your opportunities by applying to as many opportunities and companies and interviews as possible.
In addition, I think that, and I think all of his comments are very true, but I think you can maximize the chance of being at the right place at the right time by being a little creative and doing some things that some people I don't think are doing too much of, rather than just doing straight interviewing or straight sending out a resume and that kind of thing. If you have a sense of an industry that you want to get involved in, a lot of trade associations, a lot of industries have organizations or associations, and many of them are looking at international markets. And so you're getting chief executive officers or decision makers out of companies attending these association or organizational meetings, and sometimes you can get involved in those. I know that at the Minnesota Software Association, anybody can become a member of that. A lot of other organizations, there are strict membership requirements, but it's one way of plugging into an industry and getting a feel for what that industry is doing in terms of international business, and you get to talking to people, and you just don't know, you never know what's going to happen. There might be some way of finding some leads. And the more people you know in the industry that you're targeting, the greater chance that you might find a lead and get that resume in at the right time for a job.
I've been to a lot of these kind of meetings. I just want to say that this panel is the best panel, the combination that I've ever heard.
You're here.
Thank you.
That's a good note to wrap up on.
Rather than having us at one point, we're going to go all back over to where we're going to support.
I'm Kenny.
Nice to meet you, Mark.
Nice to meet you. And I understand that you're from China on behalf of some software companies.
On behalf of the whole industry,
yeah. And my question is, what do you feel about the software market or computer market in China, based on your observation or your touring of the facility?
That's a real good question.
Randall, good to meet you.
Oh, yeah, nice to meet you. Thank you.
Oh, I will. I'll see you, I'm sure.
You bet.
That's an interesting question because China, as you probably know, is so, parts of China are ultra-sophisticated. They, in some ways, are ahead of the Americans. In some fields of lasers for medicine and rocketry, aeronautics, some ways they compete are better than American technology, but in other ways they're extremely backward, and there's this tremendous diversity. In the software and computer area, they have some really sharp people that are working on software, but there are bureaucrats within the ministries, the Ministry of Electronics, that are making decisions that are impacting the research and development that are basically stifling Chinese development, I think. I mean, there are decisions such as, well, we're only going to go with IBM environment. We're not going to create a Chinese environment. That I think are mistakes in the long run. Maybe they make sense for economic development in the short run, but in the long run, I think that just because IBM and just because of the way the American business has evolved, and we have an Intel chip, the 8088 chip, and that series of chips, and the technology that's spawned by MS-DOS environment, I don't think that China should restrict themselves to our way of developing computers. And so I think that there's a kind of, I don't know, I think there's an inferiority complex among the software engineers in China that they're not as good as the Americans when they are as good as the Americans. That's my own personal opinion.
Well, because I myself is a software engineer working in a high-tech company here locally. And because I read about story about, you know, the wizard of China and your comment regarding, you know, they're underutilized for a lot of the system. And that's why I'm interested.
Oh, they are. The users of the systems, they don't know what, there's not adequate training, they don't know what they're doing. The government bought a lot of equipment, a lot of hardware, and then said, okay, we've got all this hardware, we should get some software to run it, which is not the way to go.
Are you mostly talking about application software in a specific area, like accounting or you know, database? You know,
sure. There's very little application software available for a Chinese bureaucrat or Chinese business person to use.
What about their input? You know, do they have to develop any Chinese input? You know, system or?
There's got to be 40 different projects that worked on in China and in the United States and other places in the world that are trying to develop a Chinese interface. There's one that's just around the corner in the next room. They're working on something. There are all sorts of Chinese people working on different ways so that the actual entry and the person that's entering it doesn't necessarily have to know English in order to enter in.
How often do you travel to China?
Twice in the last year.
You mentioned about that Minnesota Software Association.
Yes.
Is there any way I can get contact with that association?
Sure.
Or is that?
Can I turn this off?